From KPFT 90.1 Pacifica Houston, welcome all to this Friday's edition of Houston Indie Media. We are your hosts, Akonse, Angela Concourtney. And as Akonse, we strive to bring you news and cultural conversations to agitate, organize, and cultivate. Agitate perspectives with international and local issues, organize for self, family, and community, and cultivate spirit, collaboration, and accountability. As always, we are very grateful and humbled to share this space with you on these Friday evenings. We have a very exciting and powerful show for you today. Tonight, we have an Akonse exclusive where we are fortunate enough to be able to share Makena Tapscott's piece, where she will share concepts surrounding protest movements and riots in the South. More specifically, how it connects to Chicago-based artist Jefferson Pinder's 2019 Red Summer Tour and his performance of Fire and Movement, and which restaged the 1917 Camp Logan riot that happened here in Houston. This piece is very special to us in a couple of ways. First, the synergy and collaboration with Makena and Courtney on this piece very much exemplifies our Akonse mission to agitate, organize, and cultivate. But more importantly, it is the maiden voyage for our Akonse production initiative for our Akonse, yes, to find, collaborate, teach, and help produce docu-stories so that we can all be the media and move our stories from idea to reality. We thank Makena so much for her time and her energy, and not only for being present at these events, but for listening to her spirit that told her that this wasn't just something to be witnessed, but that needed to be captured and shared. And of course, an immense great debt of gratitude to Diverse Works for making Jefferson Pinder and his entire teams here in Houston possible, and for always holding space to present new and daring art in all its forms that honors each artist's vision without constraint, as they always, always have for the last 37 years. We are going to share the first part of Makena's interview today and the other part on our next day with you, which is going to be in 2 weeks on July 26th. And you are, after this evening, you can also hear the first part of this tonight's show at our SoundCloud.
Hello, this is Makena.
HIMC, and that's A-C-O-N-C Media _ HIMC. Again, that's on our SoundCloud. ACONC Media _ HIMC.
Hello, this is Makena Tapscott, and I would like for all of us to begin to think with me about the day the Southern Christian Leadership Conference board member Douglas Moore telephoned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and invited him to speak with students involved in the Woolworth lunch counter protest in North Carolina on the 16th of February, 1960. In Martin Luther King Jr.'s A Creative Protest speech, he states, "Victor Hugo once said that there is nothing in all the world more powerful than an idea whose time has come. The dynamic idea whose time has come today is the quest for freedom and human dignity. Men are tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. They are tired of being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where they experience the bleakness of nagging despair. And so all over the world, formerly oppressed people are making it palpably clear that they are determined to be free. You students of North Carolina have captured this dynamic idea in a marvelous manner. You have taken the undying and passionate yearning for freedom and filtered it into your soul and fashioned it into a creative protest that is destined to be one of the glowing epics of our time. Our objective with our time today is to share some of the concepts surrounding protest movements and riots in the South, more specifically how it connects to the Chicago-based artist Jefferson Pinder's Red Summer Tour of 2019 and his upcoming performance of Fire and Movement that will restage the 1917 Camp Logan uprising in Houston, Texas. To talk about this, we have gathered here today Gary Reese, a writer whose work has appeared over the years in Mule Teeth, American Short Fiction, The Texas Observer, Extensions, Glass Tire, Art Lies, and Arts Houston. Also, Jamal Cyrus, an artist who has attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, and in 2010 was an artist in residence at Art Pace San Antonio. Cyrus has won several awards, including the Lewis Comfort Tiffany Award. Lewis Comfort Tiffany Foundation Award, and the Art Adia Houston Award, and the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship. And Jefferson Pinder's collaborator, movement and tactical consultant, and Marine veteran, the artist Joseph Lefthand. So when thinking about Houston's history and the Camp Logan uprising, two things came to mind. Gil Scott Herring's "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised," and to loosely quote Malcolm X, "Chickens Coming Home to Roost." But specifically, the idea of culture as a weapon and art intervention. My first question is to Jefferson. I would like to ask, can you talk more about your performance work and your upcoming performance in Houston? And how does this performance speak to the role of an artist in community?
So beginning, I'd say maybe 2-3 years ago, I began to think about this idea of the anniversary of the summer of 1919. I was thinking about, in particular, Eugene Williams floating from the black section of Lake Michigan to the white section of Lake Michigan, and how quickly and easily he was killed by white gang members that didn't like his presence in that space, and how they threw a brick at his head and he sank to the water. The people on the beach, the gang members of the beach, held back the blacks who had helped this young man, and I can't help but to think about violence and violence inflicted on young African American lives in particular. A lot of people think that, you know, blacks intuitively have fear of water, but, you know, I think that in particular in this incident, it makes me understand where these fears come from, and how in a, you know, floating on a raft, someone can become vulnerable, and this moment of relaxation where a lot of people see as fun is also a moment in which, you know, there could be potential terror. So learning about this murder, I began to understand a little bit about, you know, what had happened and why this kind of overflowed into a kind of a social activism, violence, revolution in that community. And understanding a little bit about this, I began to dig a little deeper and trying to understand, like, well, what set the situation up for this kind of action to happen? And, you know, it was about militarization of the black body, that blacks had felt empowered to do something about it. You have these black military regiments that had been trained to fight and that fought in foreign wars in France and in Europe, and were coming home. And, you know, it's quoted that one of the black people at the beach was saying, like, "I'm going to go home and get my gun," a black vet. And so this was happening not only in Chicago, but in other places throughout the country, about 40 American cities, and on top of, like, many lynchings that took place that summer as well. But this kind of also made me think a lot about, like, what were the precursors of this? And what had happened in the mutiny of 1917 in Chicago was one of, I think, the precursors of this Red Summer, in which blacks had felt empowered to fight back, to fight against Jim Crow, to not just take abuse from what they considered to be, like, the country that they were fighting for. So these soldiers were coming back. They had a particular kind of strength, but there were a group of soldiers in 1917 that were stationed right outside the city, and the city of Houston, rather. And I think it's dynamic to think about the circumstances in which led to it's August 23rd evening, in which over 100 African-American soldiers took to the streets and went toward the police station to try to... am I going on too long about the history?
Not everybody is...
Yeah, I know. I feel like, okay, well, let me explain this. Okay, let me go back. So
I think that should be really good for you
to just kind of lay down the history. Okay. So in 1917, August 23rd, a group of African-American... soldiers had been so frustrated in their treatment in the Houston area that they decided to take on the police station. Earlier in that day, a young Corporal Baltimore had been assaulted, and they, back in Camp Logan, believed that he'd been killed by the police. So they went, and these 100 soldiers, and marched down I guess what's now West Dallas, what was San Felipe, to march toward downtown Houston where the police station was. Unfortunately, they never made it. And that is kind of where my piece begins, is this journey that started in the Negro camp of Camp Logan, a journey that was going to vindicate the community and these African Americans from all of the injustice that they'd faced over the month and a half that they were in Houston area. And so they went downtown, and I think they lost focus of who the enemy was. The enemy was anybody that approached them. The enemy was in the bushes. The enemy was, concealed behind a light that they shot out. And there was a lot of brutal death and murder. I think I would go as far as say there was collateral damage, that these were collateral deaths, rather, that many whites had lost their lives. As a matter of fact, more people had lost their lives, more whites had lost their lives in this incident than in any of the riots that happened in 1919, 2 years prior, in part because they were dealing with the 24th Infantry, known as the Buffalo Soldiers, who had an intense reputation of being an effective fighting force, not only in the Battle of San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt, but in the West, fighting Native Americans, in the South, guerrilla tactics, hunting down Pancho Villa, and then they came to Houston, where they were put in charge of guarding the building of a camp. And I guess that's always seemed kind of strange to me. It's like, here's one of the most effective fighting forces that had come to Houston to basically be on guard in the building or in construction of a military installation. And after a short period of time, they snapped. And I think this was what was most interesting to me was that it was not clear cut. It was kind of a messy situation, which a lot of innocent people lost their lives. But at the same time, it pointed to conditions that young Afro Americans were put in, where they didn't understand who the enemy was. So they in part saw everyone as the enemy, and this maybe connects to violence, to contemporary violence, I think in particular, like gang violence, where it's hard to understand who to train your weapon or who to see as being the people who are the ones that are really inflicting the damage. So what we're doing with this project is we're reenacting this march. We're reenacting this push toward the Houston police station, and within this, trying to understand a little bit about the humanity of these individuals through the movement, through the action, that in part that it's coming through the body. One of the poems that we look at in rehearsal is by this woman named Christiana Colon, and where at the very end of the poem she comments, "These days we be mourning with our feet," and I love that quote because it kind of emphasizes how movement and how through the body you can get to perhaps this idea of social activism and trauma and perhaps all the pain and agony that we carry in our bodies through an action of motion, of moving forward, of showing almost like a progression from one point to another. So in this performance, there is a progression from where the Negro camp was in 1917 to the Gregory School in Freedmanstown. And in this march, the participants will be armed in an open carry state like Texas. I think it's important to really exercise this right for us to be able to march down the street and to establish a dominance that, I don't think initially was designed for us. So I think the idea of just holding these weapons and having these weapons kind of connects a little bit to the empowerment that these soldiers had in 1917 when, they were on their way to the police station. They knew that they had an immense firepower, and they had been trained by the U.S. government to do tasks in which they were rectifying situations for the government, but in many situations never had the opportunity to be able to stand up for themselves. So this is perhaps where I want to begin, but you know, in the process of training performers of how to move through the streets and how to carry forward in, I guess, a mechanized, militarized manner, I really needed the help of a veteran, somebody who was on a rifle team. And so I enlisted the help of Joseph Lefthand. And Joseph is an artist. He's a movement and physicality specialist. And we started, like, planning, well, what would it look like if we moved down a street today in this kind of military precision, just like the soldiers were trained in 1917, what would it look like if contemporary soldiers, or contemporary Marines in this case, trained a group of black bodies, black people, to be able to exert a particular amount of military confidence and team, like, camaraderie as they move through the space? Because that is in the documentation of what had happened in 1917, it was important to realize that these were highly trained individuals, disciplined individuals, you know, that somehow had reached a particular mental place where they had to come to terms with seeing the enemy as being the people that were living next to them, the people that were, you know, inhabitants of Houston. So, I mean, I think this is really kind of a dynamic and tricky situation, but being able to be able to capture the physicality and to be able to think about, like, the precision and, the piece is titled Fire Movement, which is a military technique used in moving through space, as well as skirmish line and other techniques that we're practicing and learning. So working with a group of performers, we are training like a militia. We're training like a group of people who are going to be ready and armed and thinking, disciplined group of people. So with that, Joseph, you can talk a little bit about how the training has looked like for us, you know, up to this point. Maybe talking a little bit about the group dynamics in Chicago.
Yeah, well, that's what I find fascinating about this performative element of trying to balance, like, real life tactical training with artistic and performative and conceptual elements. And I think that's what's fascinating. Like we were talking about earlier, the concept of combat training in the military, specifically in the Marine Corps infantry, is completely utilitarian, right? It's performative, but we don't treat it that way. We treat it as a means to an end. We train a certain way to achieve a very specific goal, which is the mission of the Marine Corps Rifle Squad, is to locate, close with, and destroy the enemy using fire and maneuver, or fire and movement, and to repel the enemy's assault using fire and close combat. That's our mission, and so we train to that end. But when you take that training and you incorporate conceptual elements from art practice, that's where it really gets compelling. And I think not only compelling, but just you're walking this fine line between reality, what's reality and what's art, what's perception and what's what's individual experience in relation to the performance.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, this will be like a community based or art in the community outside of this kind of white wall gallery space. So can you talk more about, like, how that role, how this training, how that idea affects the community that it will be in?
Yeah, it's...
You want me to start?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure, that's fine. Yeah.
When going up to the area where the Negro camp used to be, I think it's, and I had, there's, it's an interesting development of different, like, commercial entities. I mean, from Velvet Taco to Kinko's, I mean, nobody really understands what used to be in that space. I think that this is, I guess, the most powerful element of this performance is people are asking questions. Why are you here? Why are you armed? What are you trying to say with this performance? And it opens up the history. It opens up there's a compression going on where there's a layering of history and location where you can't necessarily understand, you need an imagination to be able to understand what was there and what had happened there. The idea of this performance is being able to unveil a little bit of this and to get people to think that, you know, that this is sacred space. This was an area that was, you know, on this night in August 1917 was, you know, it was a pivotal moment in Houston history that somehow has been buried and forgotten and, you know, not talked about for decades. And now it's like it's our opportunity as artists to be able to share with the community where this site, the importance of this site and, you know, what it signifies for someone who's just walking down the street. And that right here at Velvet Taco, you know, one police officer was killed by a military force. You know, Sergeant Vita had his shoulder shot. Two African-American soldiers, you know, accidentally killed themselves. You know, so these are the kind of things that these are the kind of elements that I think that people aren't necessarily...
Isn't that ironically?
I think that it was friendly fire, Friendly fire. I mean, I know it wasn't intentional. I mean, I think a lot of people... But I think that's symbolic of a lot of violence that I think we're inflicting on our community now. It's like, I don't think it's intentional. Rather, it is like a result of anguish and hurt and systematic oppression. I mean, I think the list can go on and on, but ultimately, I think that sometimes we're the victims of our own circumstances. And I think this is how it played out, or how we're expecting it to examine this problem, in this performance on July 11th.
Well, it's interesting in relation to engaging the community and the idea of performativity or embodiment of knowledge or history and experience. I think this is what distinguishes it from like a theater piece, you know, because it's like there's a living history that's there, but not only it's not a straight up reenactment where we're celebrating what happened, but we're almost reprocessing in a way, like using these bodies in that space, carrying these weapons, repurposing the history and the energy of these spaces that we're working in. Something I was thinking about before is the idea of talking about the politics of weapons and weaponization. It's like, you know, the Second Amendment, it's like almost, I think of that George Orwell quote in Animal Farm where it's like, everyone's equal, but some are more equal than others. If you think about that, it's like when we take these weapons and we give them to black and brown folks, right? It's like there's this assumption the Second Amendment is for everyone, but maybe it's more for others than it is for everyone. And so I think working in this piece, it's a perfect example of like causing people to question their assumptions, you know, and that's what performance does, is it causes people to question, what are my perceptions? What are my assumptions, my biases? What's my reality? If they see something that doesn't jive with that reality, then what it does is it takes them out and causes them to question their assumptions.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're doing with this, you know. And that's what's so powerful, particularly in the first part of the performance where we're moving through a residential area that I think is predominantly white, I believe, in that first area.
The Sandman.
Exactly. But it's like, you know, where's that dividing line between living history and memory in relation to bodies and weapons? It's very compelling.
Yeah, where's the enemy?
Exactly. Who's the enemy? Where's the enemy?
And how do you establish presence? I mean, how do you know, when we think about invisibility, and you know, I feel that, you know, there's something that I've been reading again and again in the accounts is that because these soldiers had weapons in 1917, they were not treated the same way. Mm-hmm. Even because they had uniforms, they weren't treated the same way. And the uniforms were very similar to the police officer's uniform. Mm-hmm. So it was often like a mistaken of identity that these black soldiers were a representation of the law. Mm-hmm. So it's like these things were symbols of respect. So as we, you know, move through the streets now, 2019, I'm wondering how, you know, this militarization is going to be perceived.
Well, it's interesting because we are marking space, and that's something that peripherally, I think, broader society is not aware of in relation to that there's wars going on still, right, in the Middle East. The U.S. has been actively involved for the last 20 years about. But some of the... So part of the training regimen that we did is we're using 2x4s that are the same length as the rifles we're going to be carrying. And we've done patrols and training in Chicago where we're actually out in public spaces walking and holding these 2x4s as if they were rifles. And it's interesting that how people respond to even that. It's obviously not a weapon, but they see how the performers are projecting themselves, the energy that they're projecting, and how they're holding it. And we've had people say, oh, that looks scary. You guys look like you're broke, go shoot somebody, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think that's all you, really. I mean, it's as, you watch a person who's been trained how to hold a weapon for, you know, however many years, and you say, okay, this is, you know, even though it's a 2x4, you're holding it like a weapon. We're watching how you hold the weapon, and somehow we understand the empowerment, that, and then people perceive that. A 2x4 is something lethal. Like what happened today when we're rehearsing. Someone, you know, pulled aside. It's like, you guys, you know, what are you doing with those 2x4s? You look dangerous. I'm like, yeah, wait till July 11th.
Right.
For those just tuning in, this is Houston Indie Media, Aconce, Angela Concourtney, bringing you tonight's show. You are listening to Makena Tapscott's interview with artist Jefferson Pinder about his performance Fire and Movement, which restaged the 1917 Camp Logan uprising that happened here in Houston. That performance was yesterday. The voices in the room that you're listening to are Jefferson Pinder, the artist, Joseph Lefthand, his collaborator, also an artist, Gary Reese, writer, Jamal Cyrus, artist, and of course, Makena Tapscott. So let's get back to listening.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that speaks to more, and this goes back into the training, this speaks more to the concept of training. It's not so much what you're holding, it's how your mind and body is holding it. How is your mind and body... your mind and body transmits intent. And that's what in the Marine Corps they say, there's one mind, you can use any weapon if you use your mind first. So it's the same concept. Yeah, so it's very interesting that transmission of physicality and aggression too.
So I'm interested also in how social activism is inspired this way by troops coming back and teaching activist groups.
Mm-hmm. Like sharing knowledge, like each one teach one kind of thing.
Yeah, Deacons for Defense, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Even in the Black Panther Party, how a drill worked its way into almost like this street poetry or drill. And what does it mean when you have like a group of even 15 unarmed men, people, working together and with precision and accuracy, and what does that mean? Just even walking together. Mm-hmm. These are kind of things that we've been thinking about.
Well, what's interesting is that, that communicates people united behind some common goal. And I think it's disconcerting for people when they don't see that situated in a broader structure, you know? But that's what's exciting about it, is it's like seeing different body types, different ages, different proficiency levels, all united in a common goal. Which is art and performance, and in history, is something that's fascinating. Yeah.
You know, and I think the other side, I think it's important for us to talk about the other side, is like, what happens, I mean, how do you demilitarize? You know, it's like, once you learn this training, how do you then let it go? Is it possible to let it go? And that's something we've kind of come across in the rehearsal process when we're, you know, asking these people, to train us, and we realize that, you know, asking them to train us is almost re-traumatizing the individuals who have been through this experience. And it's like in watching that hurt and that pain and in realizing that's what you're asking for this person to train you how to do. You know, in our performance, this is not a drill. We had, you know, the last, I guess, 5 to 10 minutes of that piece was yoga meditation exercises in which we're trying to work on like letting go of the militarization of focusing on the breathing and putting yourself through a physical regimen that somehow that isn't about like the final kill move to every hand drill. So I think that's something that we were thinking about, you know, exploring at the Gregory School once we arrived there as the final part of the performance is like, well, we've just spent the last, you know, 3 hours, you know, gearing up. Now, how are we going to walk out of this place? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've already released our weapons at that point. We don't have them anymore. But what's happening
And that's what's interesting is it's a maturation and kind of a reintegration, which is something that art provides, performance provides, that straight up military training doesn't. And I think that's what makes this a compelling and powerful piece is you're walking this dividing line of straight up aggression and body and mind conditioning and training, but you're also treating and acknowledging the artistic spirit behind that work at the same time.
So many things pop into my head. Are you guys like ready to come into mm-hmm. things? Like also, like when you were talking earlier about the community and like, how much it's changed. I think you made a comment about the Velvet Taco or whatever it is. I mean, like how then does that affect these ideas that you're talking about now? But yeah, like I want to open it up to Jamal and Gary and know if you have any questions that you'd like to ask.
Well, I'm sure Gary can add more about this. But one of the things that you have mentioned or have said is what used to be in the space, right? And you, mm-hmm. and when you were talking about the Velvet Taco, that kind of thing. And so that area of Fourth Ward, I'm not sure how much you know about Houston history, but it was basically the first place that free blacks settled in Houston, right? And so it was basically the place that black Houston started to grow and to thrive. And it was much larger than it is right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it went into some of the most valuable property in Houston, which was probably stolen, right? But it was the business center. And from once it kind of like, just pushed its confines, then it created other parts of the city. Right, so it is the center, and it was so. Like I said, it was a very successful and self-determined area. Right, it was not an area that received a lot of attention from the city in terms of public service and stuff like that. Right, so they're talking about they had to lay their own streets and just this kind of thing. And some of the most notable black figures, in Houston history, Reverend Jack Yates, come out of that area, right? So I'm just kind of thinking, in terms of what you're saying about what drove the group of 100 plus soldiers to kind of react in the way that they did. Mm-hmm. I'm also kind of trying to tie it to that area, to that space. The other thing is that which I didn't know about was this humongous white riot that happened in East St. Louis.
Right.
Well, over 200 people, black men and women and children were killed, right? So it seems like the mind state that they were in is that it would be very difficult to discern who the enemy is, mm-hmm. And so therefore, it becomes a shadow. It becomes, people who, who may have just been trying to get out the way.
Right.
So I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking, and that along with the idea that and honestly, I thank you for bringing this, I kind of have known about it for a while, but it's not something that's discussed very often in Houston, right? And we kind of take it for granted. We kind of probably take it for granted the importance of it. But what I'm gonna say is the.
I do have to say with that though, we do have to give a shout out to like Angela Holder, and mm-hmm. we also have to give a pause for the weather, because I believe at the 100th anniversary she was intending to have like this major celebration to like commemorate it, mm-hmm. but it got wiped out because of Harvey or because of the flood. Mm-hmm. So that is something to like.
Yeah,
acknowledge. Those.
Yeah, I'm sure. Just like many of. Many of Houston's resistant histories are very underground, right? Whether you talk about Houston chapter of Black Panther Party, or whether you talk about, Houston SNCC chapter, whether you talk about People's Party 2. These histories are moving around the city, but it's very underground, right? It's not something that we all hold up and kind of remember. What I want to say in terms of the thing about the trial is that supposedly no whites were brought to justice, uh-huh. right? And this However, as you know, people have been in Houston for a while know the police department was notorious in 1917, but the police department was notorious way until like the 70s or the 80s, right? I mean, and so there's just a lot that to me points towards Houston's history of covering up these incidents. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's also partially, you know, what, you know, when you were saying like to kind of unearth what it meant, you know, like that's also kind of what you're working against and what you're dealing with.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, particularly, as it relates to the theater of the oppressed. Okay, you're reenacting these things.
Sure.
So, how are the outcomes going to be different as it relates to your reenactment based on, you know, Bola's theory about, you know, the participation of the, what is he called, the spectators, mm-hmm, within that? How is that going to affect the people of Houston and looking at a much deeper level of what the history is and how you juxtapose then to now? I'm really interested in that, and all the skeletons and all the stories that have not been told. How is the community going to deal with that? And what's, because, you know, when you get unhoused, like, mm-hmm, like you were talking about, when you're unhoused, there's a period where the clarity is very, very vivid, but then there's a period after that where it lulls and you go into that stage of forgetfulness. How is the community going to react to that? Is something I'm very, very interested in. And I'm also interested in how the police are going to react to it, how the people in the community, what's going to be the outcry in the community, particularly, you know, you're going to be confronted. You're going to be confronted. So how do you explain, right, that, what you're doing? Do you stop and give a little lecture and blah, blah, or do you keep going? How do you do it?
Yeah. You know, I think that you're kind of hitting the note on what is probably driving everyone at Diverse Works crazy right now, because it's just, there's no answer.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's the big question mark. How will people react? I feel like on one level, I mean, if we're doing our job and we're doing it, you know, effectively, I mean, we're going to be a blur. You know, mm-hmm, I think that we're going to be moving through the space almost like ghosts. But with that being said, I'm not sure what exactly it could happen and what might happen. I mean, we were thinking about the multiple scenarios of the kind of interaction we can have, but we're also thinking of it from the safety point of view. And Joseph, I know, is spending a lot of time thinking about all the variety of things, interactions that could be potentially harmful, right? But ultimately, I'm thinking that I can't prescribe it. I feel like I'm setting up a situation in which we're overlapping and we're layering history. And quite honestly, you know, these, you know, the white community members in 1917, you know, ran amok when this happened. They, you know, went to the weapons store and, you know, took arms and, you know, prepared themselves for a conflict.
Martial law was enacted.
Martial law.
The next day, the day after, the day following.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting about this project, too, is speaking about that, what are kind of the reverberations that will happen in the community after we leave, you know, after some of us leave. You know, because some of you, still have to live here. This is your home. Mm-hmm. But some of us are going back to Chicago. And what does that look like? Is it just provocation? Is it education and provocation both? You know?
Yeah, I think it's an intervention.
Intervention. But what's interesting, I think, to go back to your question about relating to the community, and especially, like, how will the public respond now? How will the police respond now? And what I'm realizing is, what we're doing is we're laying bare to see now in the present, in 2019, are those dynamics still there? Are the dynamics that caused the incident in the early 20th century, if we reenact it now, will those dynamics come up again, and what will it look like?
And the safe space, which he talks about in the theater, are you trying to create some kind of, within this conflict, are you trying to create some kind of a safe space where you have some kind of dialogue between the African-American community and the police? Or is it something that you're just trying to create something and then make people think, and then they deal with the repercussions of that on their own?
Right. Well, what I'm discovering is that there's really no safe space, and that's what the risk that's driving this performance, and that's what's exciting about it.
Very exciting.
You know, it's like the idea that it's happening out in the world, that there is going to be an immediate reaction. Even in rehearsal, there's a reaction that somehow this is even connected with the new Black Panther Party, that somehow that their crew is about the same size as ours. It's like, well, is it life imitating art or art imitating life or what? But people are going to have to deal with it the same way. And I think that this interaction, that this kind of really delicate slippage between art and reality is what's the driving interest for me in this piece. But I wish I could answer concrete. You know, I wish I could say, okay, the community is going to be able to get this, but the truth is, we're going to have to see, you know, we're putting it out on the table, and we have to see how, you know, what the interaction is and go from there.
I mean, I just think, you're dealing with so many, as Gary used the term, ghosts, right? Like, that neighborhood changed hands, like, early 2000s, maybe, but had been going on for, had been envisioned since the 70s, right? But
it was the first plan, I call it the planned community, because most of the warehouses were near San Jacinto and Runnels, near Buffalo Bayou. So, with that being Freedmanstown, next to it was Sixth Ward, which is this kind of assimilation of everyone, the Eastern Europeans, the Jews, the Russians, the Italians, the Spaniards. And so that was a workforce. They didn't want the workforce too far removed from where they lived. Mm-hmm. So Fourth Ward was right there in the middle, and it was like you could see after 1960, 1970, that their scopes were dead on it because of the proximity to downtown. Mm-hmm. So under the guise of modernity, displacement of people, and first, you know, and there was an activist by the name of Linwood Johnson that was just, I mean, day in, day out, trying to keep Allen Parkway Village, which was a huge housing department there, keep it in place. And so it's really interesting. You're bringing up and unearthing a lot of things with this performance that people have to deal with.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that I don't know if they want to deal with it or they're just going to, like, do the ostrich in the sand kind of thing and say, well, that happened, it's over with, let's move on.
Yeah.
But your performance is going to force them to look at it just like this. What they do with it is left up to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why people are reading a 2x4 as a dangerous weapon.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, what are you doing with that? You know what I'm saying? He's not Hacksaw Jim Duggan. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're reading this through a history of you know, of repression, and I think, like...
And it's like a performance. I mean, it's like gesture and line, man. It's like talking about dance.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
The gesture within the confines of African-American history, and the line as it relates to, you know, because all the dancers, the line that you cut, and what is the line that you're cutting as you're doing this performance within the collective consciousness of the community?
Right.
I mean, to me, you know, one of the interesting things about... The idea of the reenactment is like you're kind of saying that the knowledge that's shared through that process, and on some level these need to be done all over the country, right? Especially with youth. I teach at a HBCU, and I find like many of my students are not necessarily interested in engaging with the past. Right, I think this kind of potentially provides a way, an active way for them to engage with the past, right, and for them to try to make some, especially with this particular performance, make a strong connection to the present, right. And so, for me, that's one of the interesting things, the byproducts of it, right. This idea about collectivity too, you know, what y'all were talking about, like the soldiers, how that kind of group feeling is created. So I don't know, I think these are all things that are valuable things that will be left with the participants once you all leave.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about that. I mean, I feel that this is kind of an incredible moment to be able to, as an outsider, to be able to see a little something that can spark maybe people to think a little differently, or be able to recognize, because it's, I mean, I think what you were saying is really important. You know, we're coming into this environment and we're performing, and I think we have to be really conscious that this isn't necessarily, you know, this isn't necessarily our turf. But the fact that as provocateur that we can, you know, spark a conversation and get people to think about perhaps activism and policy is just an incredible privilege.
The conversation you want to spark is about activism and policy, and specifically?
Well, no, actually, the conversation I think should lead to that, you know, because I'm not an activist. I don't consider myself an activist. And I don't know enough about the policy to really be able to comment well on that, but I do know that I want to interact with history and time. And through that, I think it's going to spark interest and activate people to be able to think and to be able to understand the dynamics that we're interested in, and perhaps be able to look at their space a little bit differently. So I think it's important that I separate that, because I think there's a lot of artists who are tackling activism, like Dred Scott, you know, that it is first and foremost. For me, you know, I come from a theater background, so it's like through this theater and through this conversation, then we can then pass it on to people maybe who do that best. But that conversation is what I'm interested in. You know, it's like getting people to talk about this, or even reading the transcripts from this incident that happened, you know, 102 years ago. It tells you all you need to know about oppression and history and what blacks have had to struggle through in this landscape. At least, you know, 102 years ago, and I think that it's being mirrored today in various different ways. I think it's impossible to be able to separate that history from now. So it's like, how does that affect people today?
Well, I'll be interested in terms of, Gary, I don't know if you thought about this in regards to Houston's history too, but like, what do you think prevented whites in Houston from reacting in the same way as in East St. Louis, right? And is that the same thing that prevented blacks rather from rioting in Houston in the 60s?
Well, I think those are two different variables. I think that if we talk about the former, then you have to trace it back to the precursor, which was slavery in Texas. Slavery in Texas was brutal in comparison to other places, you know. And I don't know if it was the familiarity with the, you know, with their ex-slaves or with the African American community here that prevented them from, or maybe a sense of power that they had that they didn't feel as threatened, and that the police were the force that would keep, you know, quote unquote, them in check.
Yeah.
On the latter, I just think that African Americans in this city, financially, economically, were a little bit better off, and I think that the deals that were brokered, because you know there were deals that were brokered to save the downtown, I think that the leaders were much more amenable to taking that bait, so to speak, so as to become part of the integration thing, as opposed to other leaders in other cities. I mean, it's so funny you're saying that. I have a friend who is a leader now, and so we talk politics, and he tells me certain things, and I'm just like, oh my God, I can't believe that you're telling me this stuff. I mean, he's really telling me about his business, how he does business, and how politics is a business of favors, and I do one thing for you, and you do two or three things for me. And so I think it's a slippery slope as it relates to African American leaders in this city. But I just think that African Americans in this city are not as political and not as revolutionized as they are in other cities, for whatever reasons. I think it's economics.
But the same things happened here.
Same thing.
Same things happen here that happened in other places.
Begin to have a conversation about the legacy of Jim Crow in the South, right? Like, how can we not begin to talk about that when you think about Emmett Till, right?
Who
is this? And then Laquan, Tamir Rice, Laquan McDonald and Tamir Rice. Rice was Chicago and came down to the South, right? So there is this different kind of context or feel to this that I think has to be which would be in relationship to reactions to how white folks react to.
Well, I mean, if you dig
violence,
the same thing.
Uprisings.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, but in terms of the '60s thing, like the same things. The FBI was working here the same way that they working in Chicago, same way working in L.A. You know, we have people die here the same way we in those larger cities.
Right. Right.
But for whatever reason, the response was, maybe it is an economic piece, or maybe it was the Chamber of Commerce, you know, or maybe it was a mixture of both of these, you know. But one of the things that is that's tied to this, and I also kind of deal with this, you know, is that we are left out of those discussions, right? Whether you talk about, you know, movements within the civil rights era or the Black Power era, but very important things were happening here nonetheless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can I circle back to, we were talking about the difference between like activism versus theater or reenactment, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
I'm curious about the idea of this work projecting, because you said it can never be totally apolitical, right? There's some political element to it. But I'm curious if maybe this work is emphasizing an ethic or a set of ethics as opposed to like a politic. I got that term from a curator, Sarah Skaggs, who lives in Chicago, talking about another performance group's work. It is not explicitly political, but they touch on these very human themes about conflict and violence and that sort of thing. And I wonder if you feel similarly about this piece. You're creating questions around ethics, what it means to be a person, what it means to be a type of person in reality.
Sure.
As opposed to straight up political.
Yeah, the fact that is, you know, I don't claim it to be activism, doesn't mean it's not political.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like if I painted black boxes, inevitably they're political. I can't get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And welcome back. You have been listening to Makena Tapscott's interview with artist Jefferson Pinder. Joseph Lefthand, his collaborator, also an artist, and writer Gary Reese, and artist Jamal Cyrus. They have all been talking about Jefferson Pinder's work, and specifically his performance piece that happened yesterday, Thursday, called Fire and Movement, which restaged the 1917 Camp Logan uprising that happened here in Houston. Now, so some folks that are native Houstonians, many know about this uprising, some don't. And of course, transplants such as myself, I now have lived more than half of my life here, and I was not aware of all the deep history behind it. But so this conversation that Makena and Courtney collaborated on creating for our Aconce Media Production Initiative is really... was so deep, and it stirred up so many emotions that we really wanted to talk about how we felt about it and our reactions and observations about it, and the really deep points that were brought up by all the folks at the conversation. But we also really just wanted to present as much of the interview as possible. So the Makena's entire piece is approximately 2 hours. So it is a really great conversation. It goes so quickly. And we are going to post the entire 2 hours. But we are going to come back with you in 2 weeks on the 26th. We'll share a little bit more. And then we will go into the deeper conversation and talk about some of our top ideas, because this conversation could really go on for 3 or 4 shows just to cover the 2 hours. But again, that was Jefferson Pinder's piece, Fire and Movement. And there are still some related ongoing programs that you can participate in, which are the tours called Dark Was the Night, a tour of the geography of the Camp Logan uprising of 1917. That is done by Vinod Hobson and his Those Who Desire project. All the tours are free, and they're limited to 10 participants, and advance reservations are required. And so information on the Fire and Movement performance can be found at diverseworks.org. And info on the tours can be found at diverseworks.org, but also at thosewhodesire.com. And again, we will continue the conversation and share the next part of the interview and our discussion on our next day with you on July 26th. You can hear today's show after tonight on our SoundCloud, ACONC_HIMC. And then again, we will have the full 2 hours there on our SoundCloud as well. So we are nearing the end of our time with you. Again, this is Aconce, Angela Concourtney, bringing you tonight's show. And we will be back on the 26th with you again. But of course, some of our other Houston Indie Media folks will be with you next week. And again, we really always, as always, really want to remind folks that it is important for us to go out and agitate our perspective. There is too much going on for us to be oblivious, and to we need to organize and cultivate.
And as always, don't hate the media, be the media. And we have a little music we want to go out on. And we will be ready for the next show. So with that, we'll see you later.
Before they wake up, we stay late, we stay informed, we invest in the latest technology.
We take the time to train the next generation of doctors and nurses. We work together to make sure we heal their bodies and their minds.
We do this not because it's our job, but because this is about our veterans' lives. This is our mission. More than 300,000 of us working as one, together with families and loved ones. No matter where they live in this country, we'll be there.
We all come together and stand together to serve our veterans. We stand strong, united. Stand with us in caring for our veterans.
This year, let's go green. To save money in trees, the local station board election will use electronic ballots. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854-9663 with their name, address, and telephone number. We are missing emails for many members. Please help by visiting elections.pacifica.org and filling out a ballot request form, including the email to which you would like us to send you your ballot. E-ballots will be issued to all members with a valid email on file. Members missing emails will be sent their voter ID and password hidden beneath a scratch-off on a postcard. Ballots go out to all eligible members August 15th, 2019. You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT in Houston, Texas, and online at kpft.org.